I feel like as an adult, I don't want to grow weary of what I think about the resurrection yeah. and what I think about being saved. And so as much as I'm not trying to achieve the mountaintop high of being 14 and following Jesus, like yeah. that was such a sweet season of being a middle schooler, a high schooler. But I'm just like, okay, now I'm 35. But Lord, like, I don't want to miss, or I don't want to walk and just be in a place where I am forgetting what yeah. has happened. I want to live fully in that.
I love that. I love that. And I think that's that, you know, the resurrection, if it frames the way you think about reality, which is like, we live in a world that is fallen, and we live in a world in which God has already made this incredible, powerful deposit of healing. And I think that's, it builds that ability to have a mature posture of realism, of honesty, of grief, of lament, but also of hope, of joy.
Welcome to the Park Church Podcast, where Sunday's teaching follows you into Monday. We take biblical clarity, cultural insight, and practical wisdom and connect them to real life. Work, family, relationships, anxiety, calling, you name it. This is the Park Church Podcast, helping you follow Jesus in your everyday life. Today, we're chatting with Gary McQuinn about Holy Week, the resurrection, and some questions about James 1.
Feeling pretty good today. Feeling pretty good. It's been a good week.
Good. As we're recording this, we just finished Holy Week. So, I mean, it's a very busy week for you. Do you feel like you're getting time to kind of rest this week post Easter?
Yeah, it was like an exhausting week there's a lot of sickness stuff going around. We had family sickness stuff going on in our family. And so it was just a uniquely exhausting week. Easter Sunday is a ton of fun. I get a ton of energy for that. It's our favorite day of the year as a family. It's one of my favorite days as a pastor. It's just a ton of fun. But we definitely hit that like post-Easter like weariness.
Yeah.
Staff takes off Monday, and then we have like a fun kind of like playful kind of party. We call it a restore day on Tuesday together. So that's a ton of fun. So it kind of like eases you back into it, but then we just have loads of stuff. So yeah, definitely feeling some residual weariness, but yeah, overall, it was a really sweet time.
Yeah, that's great. I know Holy Week is such a special, you know, week of traditions for our family. I'm curious, what were some of the things you all did together?
Yeah, I love that. It's for us, we tried to make it the high points of our year. We've tried pretty hard to make Holy Week like compared to Christmas, like even like as much of a celebration, as much as something that the kids will look forward to. So my wife, who loves traditions and rituals and kind of liturgies that help us put the church calendar at the center of our year, is always really thoughtful. So we do some stuff on, like Palm Sunday is a ton of fun, but it kind of launches a whole week of trying to orient our heart towards the work of Jesus. And so we do a huge Seder supper every year on Thursday with just some family friends, and it's really sweet, but it's like, you know, smoking meat, and it's, you know, a huge ordeal. This year we did it outdoors with like a kind of like the triclinium, like the three table thing. And I make this, it's called a Haggadah, which is like a historic guide that the people of Israel used to guide through the Seder supper. But it just takes, it's like, so we kind of give everybody a part to play in the Seder supper. But it's a lot to prepare for that at a food level. Yeah. It's like a big kind of feast we throw at our house every year. And so there's a ton of work for that. It's a lot of fun. And then obviously Good Friday services. We just really enjoy, my wife will kind of on Good Friday, we put black like sheets over all the windows and put dead branches around the house. And I don't know if you do similar things. I feel like a lot of people at Park do stuff like that. And then on Holy Saturday, like after we go through the Good Friday services, similar, just kind of like a day where just let like dark and dead things kind of fill up the house and spend some time reflecting, all of that kind of paving the road for Easter, which it's interesting as a pastor, my wife has cultivated so many like sweet Easter morning traditions, but I'm typically gone. Often like one of my kids will come with me. We come early. I think, you know, so many of our staff and leaders and volunteers come so early. So, but it's a ton of fun. How about y'all? Do you guys have any Lent, Holy Week, Easter traditions?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Lent is something our, even our kids who are so little really look forward to in the Christian calendar. You know, it's that Advent, that Lent season. It was really Joel Limpick that gave me a framework for how to celebrate it as a family. And so when we were in staff meetings together, he would always talk about the different seasons of the church calendar being like neighborhoods, like walking through different neighborhoods and like, how would you spend your time there? What would the mood of the, you know, neighborhood be? And so I draw a neighborhood on a big piece of paper and I write in each of the different buildings the kind of marks of Lent. So it was generosity, fasting, and prayer. And so we just spent some time in that. But Holy Week, we also try a Last Supper situation. And this year we celebrated with Tony and Ruthie Villatoro and their two kids. And it was nuts. Like it, I mean, I'm always like 5 minutes is a win, right? Of like kids sitting and listening. And the washing of the feet with people you don't know super well was so awkward. And yet we were all just like, okay, let's do it. We're in it.
Love it.
Kids are complaining the water's too hot, the towel's scratchy, like don't touch my feet. But you know, you always hope as a parent that there's just something, like there's just some little seed planted that, you know, will come out later and blossom in your family.
But totally. So. I have this general sense that kids will like remember like the ethos of it all and not like the clunkiness of it all. They will think like, oh, we would always do this thing and it was so great. That's maybe, you know, optimistic thinking, but I like believe, like Lord help my unbelief, that they will like glean the goodness of it and somehow the clunky awkwardness will just like fade out of their memory. I think they actually are like that.
Will. I also feel like it's, you've really won in traditions when the year you don't do it, all of the kids are like, what, why are we washing the feet? Why? That's what we always do. And you're like, okay, so you are kind of like paying attention
and, exactly right.
And getting that, which is really fun. Do you have any like hot takes on the Easter bunny? Because on Sunday morning, we've got some baskets for our kids. Like we're excited, like, yay, Jesus is risen. Do you guys do baskets? Like, you know, is the Easter bunny a part of that?
I mean, to be direct and not to like take care of all the listeners or be weirdly judgy. No, you know, we don't do Easter bunny, but we do Easter egg hunts and stuff with candy. And, you know, we kind of enjoy, we've always approached some of those things. Like, are there ways for us to take some of the more cultural side of these things and, enjoy them while making sure the thrust of what we're doing as a family, like really does put attention on the significance and the way this, like the work of Jesus relates to these seasons. So we do, you know, the Easter egg hunt. My wife this year, like we had a sick kid, so we had to like cancel some of the Sunday plans. So just our crew, but she like taped all these Easter eggs to my back and my chest and had me run around so the older kids could like tackle me and be fun and funny, which was super cool. But yeah, I mean, I do have maybe a hot take about it. Well, first of all, before I answer it,
you're like, wait,
what do you think
before
about
I offend you? Okay. I grew up with the Easter bunny. I wish I could go back into my young mind because out of all of the like secular traditions on Christian holidays, like this one's weird. Like it actually is very weird. Do kids think a giant like bunny is actually hiding eggs?
Yeah.
Oh, like I don't get it, to be honest. So no, we've like never introduced that to our family. Out of all the weird things, like if we could like burn that one down, I feel like we'd all be better off.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. I mean, I definitely, the hot take would be, and this is related to Christmas. It's related to, Easter traditions, Holy Week. I have this sense that we as a society, as like American Christians, especially have like all these competing calendars. We have like the cultural calendar. You have the school calendar. You've got the Christian calendar. And it's very difficult to let all of them shape your family. So it's like, well, spring break always stacks right up around Holy Week. And so what's going to, are like our Holy Week tradition. So this year, you know, the school district had spring break the same week as Holy Week for our school district. And it's like, okay, what does that mean when, if your family has rhythms of going out of town or getting away, do you just kind of scrap all the Holy Week? It's just, it's difficult. And so without, again, being prescriptive or judgmental in the way that people need to approach it, I do think it's interesting to think, how do we increasingly allow the Christian calendar mm-hmm. to shape our calendar and to become a priority? And so for us, establishing some Holy Week traditions that we say, these are so sacred to us, mm-hmm. even though we're not governed by them, they're so valuable to us in the way we think about the formation of our family, the kind of way we want to view the world, that we are willing to kind of like not and push against where we need to, mm-hmm. Some of the secular calendar stuff. So that's the same thing with Christmas, where we don't, we do Advent and let Advent have this kind of like waiting feel versus mm-hmm. like early celebration feel. Yeah. But that means you got to really lean into Christmas tide and like really celebrate big, mm-hmm. not just for a single day. And I think similarly about Easter, if we let Lent, like to the Joel's question is like, if this season were to have its like way with you in terms of like mm-hmm. spiritual formation, what would it cultivate?
Yeah.
And so to let Lent have its like exercise, like a formative force on mm-hmm. our life, and that Holy Week exercise that force. I think it really means prioritizing rituals, habits, stories that point us to Jesus. And that's where stuff, sometimes the cultural approach to it, I think can actually undermine that and at least make it confusing. Mm-hmm. So if your kids are mostly looking forward to Santa and lose the sight of the incarnation, I think that's a miss without trying to be judgy about Santa.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Easter Bunny. If we're like mostly thinking about candy and baskets and miss the God of the universe, like is alive and active and working, resurrection power is at work in the world, then I think we miss some of the power of it. Mm-hmm. And our kids miss that narrative. They're shaped less by that narrative and more by Easter Bunny, eggs, spring mm-hmm. break narrative than like Holy Week resurrection narrative.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes so much sense. You know, this is probably the first season that our kids were really grappling with this idea of death. Mm-hmm. I almost to the point of Holy Week, like it came up every single day. Yeah. And they're like, are you going to die? Are we going to die? Like Jesus died, you know, there's just, you know, is Dude Perfect going to be in heaven? Yeah. Like there's a lot of good questions. And so, you
know,
seems
like it.
Yeah, I think they are. I was like, we will do trick shots forever in heaven, you know, Dude Perfect and Jesus. And I think,
bet he's so good at trick shots.
Oh yeah, actually, that's so true. And I think though, to introduce something then like the Easter Bunny, it just almost like wouldn't even make sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to us as adults. And I even feel like for kids who are like, hey, we're asked to really think and carry the weight of death, you know, like Jesus is going to die like this really horrible death on a cross. And of course it's like catered to their age, but this, was the first year that they really were like, whoa, this is like, sad.
Yeah.
And so to be like, woo, and like Easter Bunny's going to come hide some eggs on that morning. So I think that you're right.
Good.
Introducing that to me just would be such a huge contrast for our family.
Yeah. And I think that's the power of having traditions and, you know, you could use the word like rituals. Some people might be scared of that word, but we all have rituals mm-hmm. and those rituals or those liturgies, these little habits, really do form us. And so when you can create rituals around a season, like whether that's Lenten season or if that's Holy Week itself, around Maundy Thursday and the Last Supper and like Jesus actually, like, you know, we have been given this prescription of the sacraments that help us kind of embody that on a weekly basis, but to have time where we get to slow down and linger around some of those realities like mm-hmm. betrayal mm-hmm. and death and servant-hearted love and sacrifice and the cost of our sin. When you slow down, or even the waiting on Holy Saturday where you feel like, I'm going to slow down and let this be a weird day where I embrace disorientation, I embrace the tension of like unresolved pain, it really does help us understand and meet God in the different complexities that life brings us naturally anyways. So I just think it's such a rich opportunity for us as Christians to try to say, what does it look like to let that Christian calendar shape us more and more and to keep improving the ways we embody that without legalism, without judgment towards other people that don't do it the same way, but still like commitment, intentionality, like effort to say, no, as I grow in Christ, as our family wants to be formed in that way, as our church wants to be formed in that way, we should offer these ideas to each other and in ways that are just full of love and grace, but like hopefully helpful. You know?
I'd like to chat a little bit more about the resurrection. So we spent 40 days in Lent. We're fasting, we're repenting, and then we hit Easter and we're really excited. Honestly, Easter is my favorite day of the year, and especially here at Park. Like, it is such a special occasion. And then we move on. So we kind of are like, that was wonderful. And now it's Monday.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, I got work to do, or I need to rest up. How does the resurrection frame how we approach a life after an event that changes everything about like the world and us?
Yeah, it's such an important question. I think as we're recording this, I'm preparing to talk a little more about this in the coming Sunday. I think as we release this, it'll be the Sunday behind us. But I think a lot about what does it mean to be Easter people living in an Easter world. So like resurrection people in a resurrection world. And I think that's some of what the resurrection means. So there's the historical event. And then there's like, what does that mean about the way you approach life? So it's interesting to me, if we kind of do the church calendar piece of like 40 days of like more of a somber thing, and then to hit one big day and then move on, be like, did that almost like the kind of Advent into Christmas day, and then you move on and put the tree away and do all, you know, it feels like a miss for us to not start asking, how should this be reframing the way we think about it? So even in the Hebrew tradition, right, the feast and the festival around the Passover. So it's this Passover festival. It's the festival of unleavened bread. They would come to Jerusalem, one of the three pilgrimage feasts. They'd come to Jerusalem for a week around that. And so there is this whole community that's embodying the story of redemption, but also on the heels of Passover, they would have the Feast of First Fruits, which was the Sunday following the Passover. So Passover would be on Friday. Sabbath is on Saturday. Sunday, they enter into this incredible like Feast of First Fruits. And that would kind of launch a season, a 50-day season, until they would have Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of like the first real harvest. So Sunday, the Sunday after Passover, is the first fruits, which is like, okay, something's popping out of the ground. Mm-hmm. Like new life is coming out of the ground. And we get this really first taste of it. And then they get kind of like 50 days. And then the Feast of Weeks is like this kind of first, it coincided with like an early harvest. And you get that idea with Pentecost in the Christian calendar of like, oh, the Spirit of God is now 50 days after the resurrection poured out on the people of God. And now like the new birth that happened to Jesus on Easter Sunday, 50 days later, is just like happening in all these people as the Spirit of the living God is poured out upon them. And so I think we have opportunity for us to think a lot more in this season, but also it's what frames us as Christians. It's why we celebrate corporate gatherings of worship on Sundays, is because we're trying to say we are resurrection people. And so the idea of Jesus being risen as the first fruits of the new creation is this idea that what God did for Jesus, he is going to do for the whole world. And as we trust in him and receive his Spirit, and as we learn to live in step with his Spirit, that new creation life is like happening in us already. And not yet fully. We wait, we will still suffer, we'll still struggle, we'll still live in a world full of sin and pain and brokenness. We'll participate in that sin and pain and brokenness, we'll experience it. Death is still real. And so 1 Corinthians 15, we'll look at it this Sunday, but really talks about how Jesus is the first fruits, and the day is coming when all who have trusted in him will participate. But he's also like taking all the things that oppose his rule and reign, and he's defeating them. And the last thing he'll defeat is death, when he raises everything from the dead. And so I've been asking that question, like, okay, if new creation happened on Easter Sunday, what does that mean about the way I approach my life as somebody who's been graciously given the Spirit of God through the work of Jesus? That means I get to participate today in what God's doing to heal the world. And I get to live in a world that, like, God's healing this place. How do we know? Like, because it started. It started on Easter Sunday. Yes. God's healing this place. And so I've just been thinking a lot about how does that change the way we approach the beautiful things in the world? As like, this doesn't have to be ultimate. This is a foretaste of what he's going to do for the whole world. So we don't have to squeeze out every bit of, like, the goodness of the world. But nor do we want to, like, be cynical about it. It's real, and it's a foretaste of where the world's headed, or the suffering. There's a lot of, we have this year as a church family experienced a ton of loss and pain and suffering, and a lot of people who have walked through a lot of tragic loss. in an Easter world, you can be really honest about that. Mm-hmm. But also you can approach that pain with hope, knowing that's not the end of the story. How do we know? Because it wasn't the end of Jesus' story. He was alive. And it gives us a sense of purpose to like engage here in Denver to say, okay, we get to be like resurrection people doing resurrection, new life, new creation stuff, like loving and forgiving and being generous and kind and gracious and merciful and full of justice and patience. That's like, that's the fruit of the Spirit, is like that new creation work of God is like marked by those kinds of attitudes. So that's, I'm just like, man, we get to be resurrection people in a world where resurrection has already started. Mm-hmm. It's not done, but it already started.
Yeah.
Which is just wild. And it should change the way we approach reality. I have like obviously a sermon worth of like passion that's like being built up for Sunday.
Yes, yes.
But I feel a lot of passion about our church, feeling like we get to be resurrection people in a resurrection world, which is pretty rad.
Yeah. I think something I've been praying about is really asking the Lord to recover this childlike spirit in me. I accepted Jesus when I was 14. Like, it's been 20 years, and you're right, as an adult, enough life has happened. It still will, more will happen. Yeah. It'll shape how, it'll shape my faith and how I relate to the Lord and all those things. But I feel like as an adult, I don't want to grow weary of what I think about the resurrection and what I think about being saved. And so as much as I'm not trying to achieve the mountaintop high of being 14 and following Jesus, like that was such a sweet season of being a middle schooler, a high schooler. Like, you're just, you know, everything is wonderful and, you know, God's community is fun and all those things. But I'm just like, okay, now I'm 35. Lord, like, I don't want to miss, or I don't want to walk and just be in a place where I am forgetting what has happened.
Yeah.
And so always so thankful for Easter, for like being able to spend a day remembering and celebrating and reflecting. And then I often am like, okay, Lord, help me hold on to what I felt when I was 14, what I felt last Sunday. Like, I want to be changed and not allow life to kind of close in on that, that it's a shadow of what I really actually feel and about the good truth it is. I want to live fully in that.
I love that. I love that. And I think that's that, you know, the resurrection, if it frames the way you think about reality, which is like, we live in a world that is fallen, and we live in a world in which God has already made this incredible, powerful deposit of healing. That this is where it's all going, is what happened to Jesus. Then you can be really, you don't have to be naive about the pain, but you also don't have to be cynical or hopeless about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it builds that ability to be, have a mature posture of realism, of honesty, of grief, of lament, but also of hope, of joy, of like, and I agree with you, just like, what does it look like to not let the pain of life, and I think the resurrection is what helps us with this, like kill the hope of life. Mm-hmm. And that's a sweet, I love the way you share that. That's a sweet thing. And I think that's what we hope we all mature into as we go through. That's a lot of what, you know, James has been talking about as we've made our way through James, is a lot of that reality. And that's a lot of what James is saying to these people that were walking through hard stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, because of the lordship of Jesus, you can approach these things differently.
We want to circle back to James, and we have some questions we're hoping to chat through. In today's outrage-driven media culture, what does it look like to be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger?
It's such a interesting thing that James introduces into this chapter, where he's talked so much about suffering and temptation and trials, and all of a sudden he's saying, let everyone be quick to hear and slow to speak, slow to anger. There's this kind of surface sense in which this passage, just like being a good listener is a good thing. And that's convicting to me. I'm a words person. I process a lot. I verbally process a lot. And so there's this level into which this does and should convict people like me that are just like talkers and need to learn to listen. A lot of what he's talking about, I think, is also just an incredible indictment on our culture that is so quick to approach other people that see things differently with a sense of like, we have this need to fight for our perspective, our thoughts, our ideas being what are held, and other people that disagree become some threat to us or some threat to our sense of the way the world ought to be or people ought to think. And so I feel like it is the outrage word, I think, is right. I think we really celebrate outrage. I think even in Christianity, like the propensity to gain outrage towards people that approach even Jesus differently and have just animosity and anger is like the opposite of the kind of community that Jesus is creating. And so I think James is speaking into that reality of saying, like, what does it look like to have a posture that, because of what he calls the implanted word. So it's like, you had to humble yourself before God. You had to receive it with meekness. You had to admit you needed the life-giving work of God in the first place. And so you receive the work of Jesus, this implanted word, which is like a little seed that comes into your heart. And if that seed is growing up in your heart, what it ought to cultivate is a deep humility and interest in learning and hearing from other people about what they contribute to the world, about their perspective in the world, not being threatened by it and not being quick to try to use force or power or words or rhetoric to try to like shut people down, but being quick to hear. And so I do think, and especially in a social media kind of like online communication world, when we dehumanize people, it's just easy to cast people that don't see us or see the reality the same way that we do as like demons and enemies that need to be attacked. And I think that's the opposite of what Jesus did. He was very comfortable challenging, especially powers that pushed people away from God's presence. And that was like his anger, his righteous anger, is animated by his desire to like clear the way for people to experience the love and mercy of God. And so every time you see a sort of like righteous anger, it's like, it's because people have created obstacles to people experiencing the transformative grace of God. But the way he approached people was so honoring, treating them with such dignity, respect, love. And I think what James is saying is like, how do we look at the world like that? Even people that would be, you know, quote unquote, your enemies, that would approach the world differently, advocate for different values in society, advocate for different values in your school or in your workplace or in your neighborhood or in our nation. And how do you approach them with the kind of humility and love that feels like, because Jesus is risen, we don't have to use force to get our way. We can actually be humble, sacrificial, merciful, patient, kind, full of love, charity. And that we believe that God actually does something transformative through that without winning the argument or proving your point or defending yourself.
Yeah. I think sometimes also with media is that things are happening in our, like in our local city, but also in our like larger country. And I feel the pressure that I'm supposed to form an opinion like immediately and I need to express it. Yeah. I would be curious practically, how do we push back, like whether it's through our actions or through our words, you know, how do we communicate this? Like, can I have some time to think about this?
Yeah.
Like, can I pray about this? I feel like, especially in your role, something happens in Denver and everyone expects you to say something on Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, how are you even being like, give me a moment.
Yeah.
And yet people are like, you know, Gary hasn't said anything, so Gary must like have it wrong. I feel like, again, that's kind of the things I get.
Yeah, some suspicion or something.
Yeah. Or yeah.
Assumptions at least.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I feel that. We talk about that a lot. I think for a long time we were pretty reactive in a world where outrage, we're just like looking for something to be angry about and then looking for who are the people saying the things I want them to say and who are the people that are threatening my view on that and are the people that I'm aligned with, like are they in step with me? And you know, we as a church want to care deeply about God's passion for justice, for righteousness. He cares about the whole world. He cares about our city, our neighbors, our nation. He cares about all of it. We should care about all of it. I often think the kind of online, you know, the worst way to think about it, there are healthy ways to do this, but the idea of like the virtue signaling of just like proving I'm on the right side of this. So we have our little set of values and the way we think people ought to think, and we just need to like signal that I'm thinking the right way about this. And are you with me or are you against me in some war for the culture or something like that? I just don't see that as like a Christ-like way of approaching the idea of what he wants to do to bring restoration into the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm way more interested in how do I actually show up relationally with the people that are affected by these things? Mm. How do I interact with the people that are addressed, whether this is stuff related to immigration or justice or oppression or poverty? Mm-hmm. There are real people in my real like life that are impacted by these things.
Right.
So I'm way more interested in being the kind of person that shows up with those people, with love, with grace, with understanding, with kindness, with like the ability to push and challenge where I feel like there are ideologies that might be undermining people's like faith in God and what he's doing in the world, but also with like a desire to learn and understand stuff that I've never experienced. And so we've tried to, as a church, say, like, instead of like entering into the kind of like the global cacophony where people are like creating echo chambers and algorithms are like curating like, you know, what you want to hear and what's going to incite your rage and what's going to get you to click and make them money. I'd rather just not participate in that. I'd rather shepherd this community and interact with people that are having those questions. Let's talk about it. Where's your passion coming from? And then just be a person. And again, this is what James is saying. It's like, we can be quick to, you know, hear. But being quick to hear or even quick to speak and say what we think is very different than actually embodying it in our life and actually doing something active in the way we engage the world. And so we've been thinking, how do we not just like be reactive to headlines, but what are the things that are actually affecting real people in our community? Mm-hmm. And how do we shepherd and lead proactively to cultivate a kind of church that values the things that God values?
I really appreciate that answer. A decade ago, our small group did Francis Chan's James study on Right Now Media. And I really liked this quote that he had on, specifically, he was talking about James 1, verse 22. And he said, "Some have become so used to consuming the word without applying it that you wonder if they even can. These are spiritually bedridden, resigned to spending the rest of their lives studying the word without ever making disciples or tangibly caring for others." James talks a lot about, you know, hearing versus doing. How do you feel like James is challenging our consumer Christianity?
Francis Chan has this typical, like, very powerful way of saying it, like, bedridden is such a vivid image.
And he says it next to, like, a rock with a wave crashing against it.
Yeah, of course, you know? Walking down a beach in California barefooted or something. You know, and he's somebody who has that shaped a lot of his own decisions in life about leaving different things to really push into. He wanted to be and wants to be a person that's doing something. And, you know, I really appreciate, and I appreciate what he's doing and saying that, because it really is very, it is very much channeling the kind of energy that James has, that we can spend a lot of time hearing and listening and feel like, because I hear, because I have this particular theology, or because I teach, I mean, he's going to go on to say, not many of you should be teachers. So like, hearing alone isn't sufficient. Mm-hmm. Hearing and telling others is actually super dangerous. It means like you probably have heard a whole lot. If you're able to like communicate it to others, you've probably done a lot of hearing and a lot of talking. And there's an accountability that what we hear needs to be shaping our actual life. And if it's not shaping our life, we were deceiving ourselves. That's the way James says it. We're deceiving ourselves. So I do think that there's a real difficulty in a world where we just consume information all of the time. Mm-hmm. Podcasts, Sunday sermons, community, books, gurus, YouTube videos. Yeah. Like, I'm a consumer of information. I love learning. Mm-hmm. It's humbling and scary to think about all the things I've learned that I haven't allowed to actually shape the way I live. Mm-hmm. And so you can learn a lot about healthy eating and not change your diet. Yeah. And you can think that you're healthy because you like watched, you know, some Food Inc. or something like that, you know, some documentary. I don't know. But you can think like, that makes me healthy. And that's so foolish.
Right.
But we do it a lot in the church. Mm. We can attend a Sunday. We can study our own Bible. We can learn theology and feel pretty good about ourselves. And I think Jesus says so much to a community where that had been the reality, where their obsession with the minutia of the law wasn't a problem in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It was that they had neglected the weightier things, which is the actual execution of and activation of justice and righteousness and love and mercy. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, I think we have a lot of work to do as a church to not just like deliver information, but how do we actually cultivate like practices in our gospel communities? How do we create practices in our home? How do we as teachers do a better job of saying the so what could this look like? Mm-hmm. And I think we've been historically reluctant to give a lot of imperatives and practices because we don't want to be legalistic or we don't want to be prescriptive or, you know, everybody can look a little different. And I think there's a lot of people, this is why we're preaching through James, who are like, give me something.
Yes.
I don't know what this looks like. Nobody has shown me. Nobody has told me. And so I think we have a muscle to grow on the not just on individual doing. I feel that in my own life. But as a community that helps each other, like, so what's this going to mean? How does this shape our life? How are we adjusting our calendar and our finances and our interaction with our neighbors and our media consumption and these things to really help us be people that are actually going out in the world and contributing to caring for the vulnerable. And that's what James will immediately give those explanations of, like, caring for the orphans and the widows, the most vulnerable, under-supported, under-resourced, under-cared for, you know, communities in their age. And we live in a world where there's a lot of people that I think God wants his church to be the hands and feet of his care for them. And I think there's a lot of work for us in that regard. And that's where we'll go in chapter 2. I mean, it's going to get a lot more specific about the way that works itself out in the corporate gathering and other things, that faith without working it out is dead. Mm-hmm. So that'll be something that we'll spend some good time on in the next couple months.
That's awesome. I'm curious to just hear more specifically that, like, obedience to scripture versus just like consuming scripture and never changing. Where do you feel personally challenged by just this portion of James 1?
Yeah. Like I mentioned, for me, I love learning. I love learning. So I have like this obsession with understanding the things that are interesting to me. And that's stuff related to the Bible and stuff in life and just everything from how grass grows to like snowpack and how snowpack is affected and what the lack of snow is going to do to our broader ecology and water rights. I love learning that stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, the dark side of the moon and what Artemis 2 is doing and where that whole thing's headed. That stuff. I consume. Mm-hmm. And I often struggle to, like, I can almost become addicted to consuming and addicted to learning. And then I teach and I feel conviction around, like, how are these things affecting the way I show up in my neighborhood, with my family, with our church, with others in our city? There's some stuff specifically God's been doing in my own heart around interaction with neighbors and different things that I think I've just neglected and feel convicted about that. And, you know, go to him for mercy, but also it needs to mean something. And so I feel some of that.
Well, thank you for sharing with us today.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Park Church Podcast. Everything we do, from conversations like this to our life together as a church, is all about helping people follow Jesus for the glory of God and the joy of all people.